The gloom of the world is but a shadow. Behind it, yet within reach, is joy. There is radiance and glory in the darkness. Could we but see? And to see, we have only to look. We beseech you to look. And so at this time, we greet you. Not quite as the world sends greetings, but with profound esteem. And with the prayer that for you, now and forever, the day breaks and the shadows flee away. Welcome to the No Wonder Show on the World Puja Network. In the following hour, we have the profound pleasure of exploring from microcosm to macrocosm the extraordinary nature of reality and the phenomenal adventure of being, body, mind, and spirit on this magnificent journey we call life.
Welcome to the No Wonder Show on the World Puja Network. This is your host, Angela Russell. And I'm very excited about this show because today we have a most esteemed guest who also happens to be one of my favorite people in this whole wild world. I often describe this wonderful man as the Nikola Tesla of our time. Throughout history, there has existed the concept of an all-pervading primordial soup of energy at the base of the fabric of space. Embedded within this fabric is the primary geometric pattern of creation itself. To unlock the secret of this pattern is the next evolutionary step of science with unprecedented implications for all of humanity. Astrophysicist Nassim Haramein has decoded this pattern as a result of over two decades of tireless dedication to his in-depth research on unification, the geometry of hyperdimensional systems, and their relationship to the creation of three-dimensional reality. With his brilliance and unrelenting passion for understanding the very constructs of reality, as well as his determination to discover the underlying principles which create, perpetuate, balance, and sustain the mystery called the universe, Nassim has studied the science of advanced physics, cosmology, chemistry, and biology, as well as the wisdom and codes of the ancients. Nassim Haramein's most recent scientific paper was chosen by a panel of 11 peer reviewers to win the prestigious Best Paper Award in the field of physics, quantum mechanics, relativity, field theory, and gravitation at the University of Liège in Belgium during the 9th International Computing Anticipatory Systems Conference of 2009. So, without further delay, it is my great honor and privilege to introduce astrophysicist Nassim Haramein. Welcome to the No Wonder Show, Nassim. I'm so thrilled to have the opportunity to talk with you today.
Thank you for having me on the show. How have you been?
Been phenomenal, but I'm getting better.
Wonderful.
So before we get going here, I want to congratulate you on the awards and recognition that you've been receiving. It's been a long time coming, huh?
Yes, it's exciting to see the information get more and more recognized because it brings more awareness to the population out there, so I'm excited about it.
And all the recognition is well-deserved, indeed. You're finally getting a lot of notoriety. You've been traveling the world, giving lectures, and becoming quite famous in the world of physics. So how has that affected your life?
Well, concentrating so much on the research and all the tasks at hand that I haven't had much time to think about it. I'm most excited about the enthusiasm and the excitement in the public at large and people's life being changed and transformation occurring in people's understanding of themselves and the universe around them and their relationship to it. And I think that really is what keeps me going.
Yeah, because you're out there changing the world in a way that's very much needed right now. So let's begin talking about your life and your science. I wanted to quote Albert Einstein to begin with. He once said, "The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. One cannot help but be in awe when contemplating the mysteries of eternity, of life, of the marvelous structure of reality. May we never cease to stand like curious children before the great mystery into which we were born, for it is the source of all true art and science. In the eyes of a child, there are not seven wonders of the world, there are 7 million. So, Nassim, you must have been one of those children who was extremely curious and truly in awe of the wonders that surrounded you. Do you remember when or at what age your quest began?
All my memories from early childhood was really a fascination with the world around me. I was the kind of child that didn't take it for granted that it should just be there. I was very inquisitive about my surroundings. And then eventually I realized that there was some inconsistency in the way we were thinking about the world around us, and I thought I could give a contribution.
So you were asking some of the basic fundamental questions like, who am I? What is life? How does it all work?
Exactly.
So you went on to actually endeavor to answer them.
I think most children have that sense of questioning, and eventually most people lose that. I think in my case, I had this continuous interest rekindled in many different moments of my life, which propelled me forward as well.
So you were born in Geneva, Switzerland, and your experiences throughout your life as a professional skier and as a mountaineer and as a scuba diver provided the dynamics through which you explored the mysteries of creation. Can you share with us some of the highlights of those dynamics? For instance, how did you become so driven in this quest for knowledge and understanding of the mysteries of existence?
I felt like there was an unseen world active in the dynamics that we saw in nature, and that nature was a representation of a deeper reality that's present and not necessarily accounted for or understood or experienced directly, although it may be the source of our own existence. I think that a lot of the sports that I was doing and being in nature and being deep into meditative modes, you know, the zone of the athlete when you're climbing a sheer wall or when you're skiing extreme terrain. And they can be in that zone, you know, an experience of a deeper reality and a communion with nature that maybe go beyond the biological and past the atomic function of nature into unseen world that I believe was feeding the foundation of reality.
And certainly when you're in those extreme sports, it puts you absolutely present in the moment. You have to be fully present in order to even survive.
Yes, absolutely. For instance, you know, I did a lot of solos where you're climbing without ropes and protection, and so any error is fatal. And in that zone, there is this deep connection, this deep sense of communion with the rock, with the trees, with the birds, with all of nature around you. And when you experience it at that level, there's a sense that there's a connection, that there's a fundamental metric at the base of it that feeds everything into life. And when that came to me, it was clear, and it was early in my childhood, actually. I remember thinking that space was not empty when I was approximately the age of 10. And so this came early, that I felt that there was an unseen world at the base of our reality.
Yeah, and those are those moments that we live for, which are the moments where we really have that attunement with all of life. And so your life provided you with lots of those moments, it sounds like.
Well, that moment specifically, when I was 10 years old, I'll remember it always. I was staring at a tree across from the window of the classroom I was in because, like usual, I wasn't paying attention much. And I got this idea that there may be something in the space between me and the tree that made it so that we were connected. And that was my first thought about the possibility of space having a fullness to it, having an entity, having energy in it.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you're staring at the moon and you realize that the sunlight is actually bouncing off the moon and touching your eyes and going into your body.
Right. It's like realizing that it's a large assumption we have, that the space between things is empty. And there's lots of evidence that it's not. Actually, much of that evidence is well known. For instance, the fact that there's electromagnetic fields and RF waves and radio waves and all sorts of the electromagnetic spectrum. And so there's all sorts of dynamics like the sunlight that are occurring in the space. And we tend to ignore that and think of space as empty.
Certainly, those invisible realms give credence to all that we see.
Well, as I found out, it's a feedback between the two, meaning that not one is the source of the other, but that there's a feedback between the two. It's never the egg or the chicken. It's always both.
We've mentioned quantum physics on previous shows, and it seems that the most fundamental concept of the science of quantum physics is that of a unified field, of all-inclusive oneness, which reveals ourselves as entirely and absolutely interconnected with all that is, which is what you've been saying. And as you know, there is also a primary metaphysical principle that there is an intelligent, all-pervasive, unfathomable phenomena, an ocean of consciousness which manifests itself as all that exists. And this unlimited, indestructible, eternal presence is also termed the source, the creator, universal intelligence, infinite love, supreme consciousness, the great spirit, primal cause, the force, the mother-father principle, divine essence, the law, the word, the Tao, and so on. But typically, we don't refer to it as the unified field or the void or the vacuum of hyperdimensional space. Yet, are they not all one and the same? Is science now understanding and defining the nature of what we call God?
Well, you know, this is interesting. I keep saying that spirituality and religious beliefs in their spiritual function are the physics we haven't understood yet. And I think we're catching up to some of those fundamental concepts that have been there for millennia. For instance, the chi is another one. And I think that it's really remarkable that we can start to describe these concepts in appropriate physics and mathematics and understand the fundamental dynamics that relate the metaphysical world with the physical world. The metaphysical world not being elusive anymore, actually more of the new physics, which understands that the material world is linked to the vacuum structure, as you just described, as an analog to everything that we call creation or God or all sorts of descriptions throughout the ages, and that the vacuum structure actually flipped the bill to describe all of these phenomena, like, you know, omnipresence, it's everywhere, omnipotent, you know, it has all powers in it. And it becomes very important that we are able to understand the physics of these concepts, because then we start to understand the key of creation, the fundamental relationship between the creation of matter and atomic structures and biology and the whole physical world we see, and the energy that drives it, the information network that drives it, that is actually the space between the things we see, and that this relationship between the two is a feedback that we're part of. And thus, we are influencing this fundamental structure of creation as it is influencing us using the material world around us as a feedback.
So, in essence, the new physics is currently providing a foundation of knowledge that upholds what the mystics and masters and seers and sages throughout history have known and taught. So I'm interested in the aspects of your science that is in alignment with the wisdom codes of the ancient. How do your discoveries uphold ancient esoteric knowledge?
Well, you know, it's normal that the new physics, if they were accurate, would be a description quite well aligned with great philosophers and great thinkers and spiritual masters all around the world, because if there is such a fundamental energy of creation in the structure of the vacuum, and that it rules everything, it connects everything, it links everything, then high, powerful individual with a great, capacity of communion with nature and so on, should be able to come with concepts that are very close to the physics of creation, philosophical concepts that eventually, in a society that continues to evolve, should be described in mathematics and in physics. Because at the base of science, philosophy is always present. One must have a concept, an idea, and a sense of a system in order to describe it, in order to write physics to it that may be accurate to the physics of creation around that system or in the system. And so this is fundamental to the evolution of a society. Usually, I always mention that in order for Einstein, for instance, to have his concepts or his thoughts in relativistic equations and relativistic physics, he had to have concept, fundamental philosophies of creation that led him to write these equations in this way, that led him to develop his theory in this way. And so philosophy is always present prior to the development of the concepts into the mathematics and the understanding of the material world. But it's very interesting that when we look into ancient civilization, as far as we can look, we find these concepts very, very prevalent, stated very, very clearly in many, for instance, very ancient Indian texts, as well as hundreds of different texts around the world, describing this fundamental concept that there is an energy at the base of creation, that all of matter emerges from that energy and returns to it, and that everything is connected, that there's a relationship between all things, and that relationship might be called God in some cases, and so on. And when we look at that, and we actually look at this possibility in physics, that there is an energy at the prevalent, at the foundation of creation that feeds all the material world, which is basically what I describe in physics and mathematics in this last paper that you mentioned, the Schwarzschild proton, showing that the proton, the atomic structure, is actually fed by the structure of the vacuum. And this actually is like the manifestation of these concepts that comes from very ancient source. For instance, from this equation that I derive in this paper, I can show that all protons are correlated, that they're entangled, that all protons, because of the structure of the vacuum, are connected, and that the all mass of the universe is one entity, one system, which is a concept that's found in many different ancient civilizations and traditions.
Yeah, so essentially, you're discovering, and it's really all about understanding the mysteries of existence and looking into those mysteries and see how does reality work.
Right.
You know? And so it has implications for all of us because of that.
Right. And most people are intimidated by just even asking that question, because in many cases the tendency is to think, well, we'll never figure it out because, you know, it's beyond us. But there's a flaw in that thinking. That is, we are part of nature. We are nature. So if we are part of the system, then the dynamics of that system and the mechanics of that system are present inside us. So we have the link to the information to understand the fundamental structure of creation, since we're part of it.
Because we are the link, and that's another thing that I want to hear about and get into. Because, well, weaving together the sciences of advanced physics, cosmology, chemistry, and biology, as well as the wisdom and the codes of the ancients that we've been talking about, you explore the idea of a unified tapestry of space-time, which led to your discoveries that may prove to be some of the, what I feel to be some of the most important scientific, philosophical, and technological discoveries of our time. So let's begin to talk about this extraordinarily significant paper, which marks a new paradigm in the world of quantum theory. My understanding is that your revolutionary discovery not only unifies the theories of the opposing branches of physics, but more importantly, provide a foundational cosmological understanding of universal forces, including consciousness, which is what we've been discussing. Can you somehow convey to our listeners the basic principles behind your work and your theories? Perhaps you could take us through the evolution of physics, beginning with Einstein's field equation to Carl Schwarzschild, to Kerr and Newman, to your own discoveries, because it seems so important that their convenient, what you refer to as convenient solutions in their model of physics, such as dark matter and the strong or weak forces, become rather obsolete in the light of your model and understanding of how these forces work.
Yes, I was able to eliminate some of the most fundamental forces of quantum theory and show that they were actually related to gravitational and electromagnetic fields. And actually use semi-classical mechanics like Einstein's field equations to solve at the proton level the nuclei of an atom, which is usually dealt with quantum theory. So here I made a link that's been thought of and that actually Einstein spent most of his life looking for. He believed that his equation could solve for the atomic level, but at the time, concepts of singularities of black holes were not very well understood, and it didn't occur to anybody that the nuclei of an atom could be a black hole. And that leads us to the history of such equations that describe black holes. The initial solution to Einstein's equation of gravitation were produced by a fellow called Carl Schwarzschild, which was a physicist that lived in Germany when Einstein published his equation. He was there on retrieve from the front in Russia, where he got sick at war and had to be sent home. And he solved these equations. Looking at the result, he realized that it predicted an entity that eventually would be called a black hole. It predicted an entity that could absorb all the electromagnetic field. And so he sent those results back to Einstein, and Einstein was very happy that his equations had been solved, and he got these papers published. And unfortunately, Mr. Schwarzschild died very shortly after he had sent the papers to Einstein. And so he never furthered these equations, where at the initial instance he had used approximations. That is, his first iteration of solving these equations, he didn't think it was necessary to add spin and charge to the model. He wanted to keep it simple. And so it took until 1965 with Kerr and Newman before charge and spin was added to the model. And there again, there was an anomaly that occurred because of the way the equations were ran. The frame of reference was rotated with the singularity or with the event horizon so that there would be no Coriolis forces and torque apply on the system. That is, the assumption is that the system is spinning as an initial condition, like for say everything got spinning in the Big Bang, with no explanation where the source of energy to spin all these objects comes from. That is, there's no source for spin in our current model. So then I came along with Dr. Rauscher and said, well, this should be a source, and that source should be a fundamental torque in the structure of space-time. And so instead of space-time just curving as Einstein had described it, And, you know, a good example of Einstein's equation is a ball on the trampoline curving the surface of the trampoline, attracting other balls. So our equation said, well, actually, when the trampoline curves, it curls just like water going down the drain, and it applies a fundamental torque or spin to the system, and thus bringing everything into existence through the structure of the spin, and bringing in charge and the foundation of mass and so on. And so we start to write equations to modify Einstein's equation to add torque and Coriolis effect to the system. And then eventually we applied this at the atomic level, looking at an atom, because very early, when I was around the age of 10, I realized that atoms may have infinite possibilities, infinite division in them, that an atom could be divided into a nuclei and then a nuclei into a smaller particle, you know, and from the proton to the quarks and so on, and you could go to infinity that way. And so I thought maybe the atom is a mini black hole, a mini singularity, very early. And so we applied this new understanding to the way the proton functions in the nuclei of an atom, and solved it as a mini black hole. And as we did that, we were able to eliminate the strong force, because if you have a mini black hole proton that's attracting another mini black hole proton, you get exactly the force you need to hold the atom together without the need of a strong force, which was really added in an ad hoc way almost 100 years ago. And that strong force that was added had never been given a source. Like, there was no explanation where the energy comes from to produce the strongest force in the universe. And so when I solved the nuclei of the atom, the proton, as a mini black hole, then all of a sudden I was able to eliminate the strong force, and the information I was getting, the result of the equation, was outputting many of the constants that you find for the nuclei of atoms, both in theoretical constants and measured values in laboratories. So actually, it was a good way to describe the nuclei of an atom in a much more simple way. But it didn't occur to Einstein, because at the time, black holes were thought to be very exotic, and it was thought that no such thing was ever going to be found, and that part of Einstein's field equations that predicted black hole was just an anomaly in the mathematics, but that there was no actual physical reality to it. But eventually we found black hole in astrophysics, and I predicted from this theory that they were going to find one in the center of all galaxies, and they did. And now we see black holes everywhere, inside galaxies, at the center of them. You know, there's many speculation about mini black holes everywhere. And so it's now becoming clear, and certainly from these equations, which makes a radical change in the understanding of the physics of the quantum world, that the atomic structure, everything you're made of, everything that everything is made of, is made out of mini spinning black holes that are spinning continuously at near the speed of light, and that's why the electron has such velocity and so on. And because of the scale at which we observe these things, they're very small, we think of them as very stable in the material world that we see around us. You know, it seems hard and not very active, but it's quite active down there.
So what is dark matter? And isn't that one of the convenient solutions that you spoke about in your lectures?
Yeah, well, you know, when we solved the equation to describe our universe as a whole, and we matched it to the observation of the way matter moves in our universe, it didn't match. It turned out that the standard model was missing some 96% of the mass necessary to make it do what it does when we look at it, based on the equations that we use, Einstein field equations. And instead of revising the equations, looking at them and trying to find solutions in the mechanics this idea was promoted that maybe there was some matter that was having physical properties such as creating curvature and producing gravitational field, but that was not visible and could not be detected in any other way. And it was just added to the equation to make the equation work, including dark energy and so on, to make everything work. Well, you know, that's what I call physics as you go. The equation doesn't work, you just start to invent things and stick them in there in exactly the right proportion so that your equation works. I don't necessarily agree with that approach. So I realized, first of all, that the torque that was omitted in Einstein's field equation and the Coriolis effect accounts for that, but as well that the mass of the universe is not quite what we think it is because the proton atoms are mini black holes. And so there's a difference in the way we think of mass, because in standard model, mass is not explained either. The source of mass, how does mass occur? The source of energy. That when you start to modify these concepts, when you start to realize that there's an energy at the base of the vacuum that's feeding everything, then all of a sudden you don't need all this dark matter and dark energy anymore to make things work.
Well, so I'm curious, how much science, how much of our technology is based on those so-called convenient solutions that really have no basis in what you're talking about? How much science is based on that?
Well, you know, I think that a lot of science is based on the concept that we live in some kind of absolute vacuum and that there's no source that's spinning things, that everything is just the result of a big bang that happened some 13.7 billion years ago and that we're spinning in a frictionless environment since then. But there's lots of evidence to the contrary. And actually, when we start to discover that the structure of the vacuum is the source of the material existence, then we may be able to create devices and technology to actually connect to that and use that as we use the energy after it is converted to matter, you know, but actually link into the energy prior from the conversion to matter.
Yeah, so it really fills in the blanks of these inappropriate solutions.
It's the filling in of the vacuum blank.
Yeah, exactly. So you have this model of the Coriolis forces in a dual torus manifold that has a perpetual motion dynamic. And I have to say to our listeners that if this all gets sounding a little bit complex, there is a 4-DVD set that is so wonderful to watch because it makes sense to lay people such as myself. And there's so many of us that are interested, and yet we need to have it broken down into simple terms. But my question is, this Coriolis force in a dual torus manifold that has this perpetual motion dynamic, how much does that relate to free energy, the possibility of self-perpetuating energy sources?
Well, I think it's the fundamental geometry of that flow that drives everything into existence. And so it's that fundamental feedback between a singularity, an entity, an individualization, and the whole, which is the whole, W-H-O-L-E, being the space that connects all things. And so that feedback has a very specific topology that you described, the double torus, because this Coriolis effect, so you have one torus, and for the listeners that don't know what a torus is, think of a donut with a hole in the middle. Imagine two of them, one on top of each other, stacked up, and one spinning in one direction and the other one spinning in the other direction due to Coriolis effect. And that feedback between the pollodial flow, which is if you took your donut and you twisted it from the edge towards the center, if it could roll onto itself that way, that's the pollodial flow. And the toroidal flow, which is the rotational movement of the donut itself, the two relating to each other, producing a feedback between the center of the donut, which has the hole, right? So the center of the donut is where there's the interaction with the space. In this case, the center is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. It's the size of a Planck's distance, a teeny-weeny point called a singularity. Actually, it's a point billions of times smaller than the atom, and according to the Big Bang, that's where all matter came out of. The difference with my model is that I'm saying the Big Bang is constantly happening. It's a continuous creation model. And so every atom is one of those little singularities. And so if you think of it that way, then there's a feedback between the edge of the donut and the center of the donut. When it's going in, it's the gravitational field. When it's going out, it's the electromagnetic field. And there's only these two forces in nature, one that's contracting and one that's expanding. The one that's expanding is a force that is radiative, that is towards entropy, and the one that's contracting is a force that is towards syntropy, towards center, right? And most of our technology is based on the force that's radiating, the force of entropy, which neglects the force of centropy, the force towards the center, which is the force that actually organizes the system so that it can eventually radiate. It's the force that creates, it's the force that organizes before it goes towards disorganization. And it's the force that produces the continuous emergence of higher and higher levels of complexity. So it's a much more generative, it's a much stronger way to interact with nature than to interact with the radiative force, which has consequences in our environment.
Well, that's really interesting to me because what you're describing changes the way one might view all of reality, because I think what you're saying is that it's all being created and recreated every second of every day through this feedback.
Yes, and that we're part of it.
And so that has amazing implications. I have a question about being the observer of that. Because as we evolve ourselves into these new and rather extraordinary levels of understanding, we do begin the process of reconsidering and reperceiving and realizing all that we are, and especially as observers of life itself and of that regenerative, recreational process every second of every day. So as an observer, we affect that.
Oh, yes, we do. And at the same time, we are being affected by the feedback that nature gives us back. So it's a relationship, and that's really important to understand. The tendency is to either understand one or the other. That is,
right.
Yeah, the tendency, for instance, for a scientist is to understand that we are affected by the environment, and the tendency for the spiritual person is to think that they're influencing the environment. But really, it's a feedback between the two. There's always a relationship, and that's why the system learns about itself and grows and evolves. It's a dynamic balance, and it's a wonderful thing to start to realize, because then when you realize it, you can become a conscious participant, what I call a vacuum engineer, and in the feedback. and that can have really amazing results.
So what about free energy? I read a book called The Coming Energy Revolution, which is just one sad story after the other about scientists and inventors that have been bought out and shelved or threatened or killed or, you know, had some sort of catastrophe with their science, but that we've actually had free energy science for decades. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that there was a lot of times in history where we could have taken a different term, and I think it goes back almost 5,000 years. So, yeah, I think that this knowledge and this understanding has been present with us for a very long time, and I think that in some cases it was even applied to technology, and not necessarily so recently. You know, there's a lot of evidence that ancient people could do quite remarkable things. And so I think that we've had this in our background for a very long time. And in general, I don't use the terminology free energy because it produces a little bit of misunderstanding. Everything is free. All atoms are spinning absolutely freely. Nobody is paying for them to continue to spin, and they're quite good at it. And so it's just a question of discovering the source that fuels all this. And when you discover it, then you can use it just like, you know, the rest of nature uses it. And it's a very powerful force because it's what produces all of creation. So there's lots of energy available. And the universe is not cruel. It didn't put us here and left us with limited resources, knowing that eventually we'd run out. It's an opportunity for us to discover the true fundamental power at the source of creation and to transcend our sense of limitations. And so I think we're eminently getting there. We're very, very close.
But do you feel that self-perpetuating sources of energy are already in existence?
Yes. All atoms self-perpetuate by feeding in the vacuum. I just want to make that clear because it's very important for scientists, listeners, and physicists to understand that I'm not saying that there's a violation of the laws of physics. I'm just saying that the system that we, nothing in the universe, can be isolated and in a closed system. It's always open system. And so a technology could tap into a source of energy that is not currently known or understood. And if it does, then it would appear to us as free energy or some kind of miraculous thing. But actually, it's just using energy at a different level than using the energy we use when we make a water falls through a turbine to produce power in a hydroelectric dam, or when we use nuclear material to heat up water and power a turbine and so on. We're just using the energy after it's been converted to matter. If we tap into the energy that produces matter, that drives matter, then it's a much more appropriate thing to do, I believe, for a more advanced civilization. And the result is that there is no negative effect on your environment or any pollution or, you know, any mining is necessary, and the energy is available anywhere in the universe.
That's where we're headed.
Well, you know, I believe that this is the destiny of all civilization, that eventually reach a higher level of consciousness and realize their relationship with the universe.
Well, so in essence, what you have discovered is that the intelligence of this vacuum creates, perpetuates, balances, and sustains all that we perceive within a very specific, fundamental, mathematical boundary structure, so that the infinite potential of everything is present in everything. And that reminds me of a previous show where we talked about the illumined ones throughout the ages have taught as above, so below, as within, so without, that there is no separation between physical and spiritual, visible and invisible. And we are coming into an understanding where, although there's no real division between the two, there's certainly infinite possibilities of the one. So what part does a biological human, you know, this state-of-the-art diving suit that we have to house our dynamic consciousness, what part do we play in the context of the structure of reality?
Well, you know, it's a good question because it's very important to understand this. When you start to realize that you're part of this feedback, you're part of this relationship between you and all things, meaning that in an infinite universe, in a universe that is multiverse, meaning that our universe is in a larger one, that's in a larger one, that's in a larger one, and there's infinite amount of division towards the nuclei of an atom, then every point in that system, like a hologram, is the center, and a fractal structure can emerge from it. And in this function, then every point is observing the universe from its very specific center. And I don't mean that only philosophically. I mean that mechanically, because of the coordinates of space-time, meaning that, you know, you're not the center of this universe, because we know you're not the center of this universe because we know approximately where that is. But you're the center of your universe, which is most likely much bigger than this universe, right, if you're the center of it.
Certainly your science, your geometry reconciles the paradox of how can we all be in different locations and still we're all the center of the universe, because every single one of our realities goes infinitely outward and infinitely inward.
That's right.
We are the event horizon between the inner and the outer.
That's right. Because there's two directions in the universe only, and that is either outward from a point or inward from a point. And that defines each point as an individuality, and each of the individualization observes the universe from its own very specific point of observation, which is unlike any other point in the system. And so you have an immense influence in terms of you are the only one that's observing the universe from your perspective. And so you're feeding the universe a very specific set of information, and everybody else is as well. And so it's the combination of all these sets of information is the consensus reality of all these sets of information mediated by the vacuum, meaning that the vacuum is managing all the relationships so that there's a consensus, so that we can all be meeting each other in the same universe. So we have most of an effect in our local environment, although we have the capacity through our connectivity to all things to have a larger and larger and larger effect on the universe with an infinite amount of probability. That is, we will never get to the end of it. We will always learn. We will always get more complex. But that is based on your capacity to grow, if you like, from one bubble of your universe to the next one, from one fractal structure resolution to a new fractal structure resolution.
So that kind of gets into the holographic aspect of your model.
That's right, holographic and fractal in nature. So that's why the model is called holofractalgraphic, because it's a combination of both. And without giving too much details on that, time not permitting, the concept is that because everything can be divided to infinity, then each division represents a resolution on the structure of space-time, a resolution of the fractal structure, all the way down to the atomic level, and each resolution being a boundary in the structure of a fractal geometry. And then eventually I explored the geometry and found some fundamental geometric structure, which I believe is at the base of this structure of the space-time manifold that produced this effect.
Again, it's so aligned to certain philosophy and metaphysics, but I have to recommend to our listeners that in order to understand all this in a way that's very comprehensive, it would be most wise to order your 4-DVD set entitled Crossing the Event Horizon, Rise to the Equation. So before we wrap it up here today, there's just a few things I would like to hear from you about. And one is about 2012. You know, there's all these movies coming out, and there's so much talk, and there's so much prophecy, and, you know, the Mayan calendar, the end of time, and all that. And I'm really interested to hear your view of Earth changes and 2012 and also crop circles. Are they communicating important things to us right now?
There's many parts of that question, but I would say that there is definitely a change that's occurring, both in the physics of our solar system as a whole, and maybe our, you know, our local section of the galaxy, but as well in our consciousness, our society, and in our financial structures and our scientific structures and so on. And so there's many levels of the change. There's many levels of evidence that we are going through a transition at this time, and that some of the transition may have to do with changes on the surface of our planet that may actually come very much earlier than thought by the standard physical analysis. And the ancient texts seem to have had understanding of these periodic changes and were able to predict it. In many different ways, this predictions, these calendars, in combination with many other pieces of evidence, such as buildings all around the world that were built with enormous precision and extremely large stones, and all sorts of anomalies that we find along our history, show that there was some kind of interaction, it seems like, with very advanced knowledge, very early in our evolution, and that a set of information has been carried forward from all these civilizations to tell us about this change that we're undergoing. What I like to concentrate on is that this change that we're undergoing in most of these traditions that predicts it, and there's many, is thought to be a birth, a transformation towards positive outcome. And for all birth, there's a little moment there that can be a little bit iffy. And I like to associate it with an oscillator in laboratory. If you put energy in an oscillator, it will vibrate, and depending on its tensile strength and its elasticity and so on, it will oscillate. And if you keep pumping it with energy, if it's able to maintain its physical structure, it will all of a sudden pop into a new frequency, a higher frequency of coherency. But just before that, it's very chaotic. And I think we're in that chaotic phase just before this transformation. And I think that actually this transformation, we're in the middle of it. It's driven by consciousness. It's like people are accelerating very rapidly now at this point. And there is technology that is eminent, that's emerging, that is going to transform our world very fundamentally, the way we are able to interact with nature and be in the world and interact with our universe. And it's propelling us to this new level, to this amazing transformation, like the lotus opening and flowering that our society is experiencing right now.
So if it all has to do with oscillation and frequency increase,
mm-hmm.
then that would sort of explain the speeding up of time, the sense that time is speeding up, because you hear people talk about that, you know, and also the idea of, you were saying that if you speed something up in oscillation and frequency, it pops and goes to another level, that's another dimension, right?
Well, it's another level of energy, it's another level of frequency, you know, it's a coherent oscillation, and you could think of it as a different dimensions. I use that word tentatively because dimensions mean many different things to many different people, but certainly I think we're transcending, is what I call crossing the event horizon. It's like moving through a boundary, moving through a limitation in our capacity and in our understanding, even in our physical whereabouts, meaning being all of a sudden able to go to other planets casually in our solar system because we have gravitational drives. Well, that will fundamentally change your world. That will fundamentally change the way you think of your life and what you do during the day and so on. And so I think we're at that edge. We're right there just before that transformation.
I remember a few years ago sitting in Hawaii, you know, watching a sunset with you, and you are, of course, primarily an astrophysicist, and so you watch the sun, and you said something about the cycles of the sun being very erratic right now, and that it's possible that the outer layer might become extinguished for a moment. What's
yeah.
happening with that?
Exactly. You remember when I was describing that, I was saying that it was getting hot, and then all of a sudden, a year and a half ago, it started to get very, very cold. And the coldest it's been in all of the recorded history of the solar dynamics. And so that is what I was describing, is that because the sun is undergoing a transformation, and there's many reasons why that's occurring, and we don't have the time to get into it here. But remember now that the theory I write shows that everything is a black hole. Well, the center of all galaxies are black holes, so the center of solar systems are black holes, seeing that the stars have little black holes in them. And I wrote physics to that matter. And that the black holes go through cycles of radiation and cooling down and radiation and cooling down. And these cycles, for instance, are expressed in our sun as the solar cycle, for where every 11 years the sun flips its magnetic poles and become hotter and again cooler again and hotter. And then there's longer fractal cycle of these events. And the Mayan calendars, for instance, map both. They map the smaller cycles, and the long count of the Mayan calendar map the larger cycle, and that this larger cycle we're in at the end of that cycle right now, and that the sun is transforming. And so when the sun transforms, it has aspects of it that influence the planets around them, because the sun is 99.8% the mass of our solar system. All the planets put together don't even make 1% of the sun's mass. So when the sun changes a little bit, it makes a big difference in the solar system. So we are undergoing changes. I believe that ultimately all these changes are positive, because it's propelling us, it's forcing us. It's what I call the universal 2x4 behind the head, you know. I've had it many times in my life. It kind of moves you along. It produces all the dynamics in the environment, all the stressors in the environment to force evolution, to force transformation. I think that's what we're undergoing now.
That motivates us to recreate in better ways.
Exactly.
And to heal and all of that. So one last question. Any recent crop circles that you've deciphered that aren't on your DVD set or that have interesting information?
Well, I've definitely looked at the crop circles every year since then. And, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them that have very deep meaning in the physics that I'm writing. Now, are all crop circles done by sources other than humans going out there and making them in the fields? Probably not. However, some of them, and those ones usually are extremely accurate. They have all sorts of properties that are not possible to be reproduced by humans and so on. Those ones, I believe, have very significant messages for us. And if you were to make a compilation of the overall message, I would say pay attention to the fractal geometry, pay attention to spin and angular momentum, pay attention to harmonic relationships, because in those is the key to reality. And so I'm very excited about many of the crop circles that have occurred this year, many incredible creations, beautiful ones. And I think it continues to pulse the human consciousness by giving sets of information that we may not understand at first sight, but that land very deeply into our consciousness and into the fundamental structure of our existence to unlock, so that we start recognizing the codes of creation that we are actually made of and present with.
That's just about as exciting and as good as it gets when we have that kind of input from mysterious sources that you can actually decode and decipher and that communicate to us.
Yes, and, you know, I think that these mysterious forces are not going to be very mysterious for very long anymore. I think that that is part, actually, of the transformation that society is undergoing, is to realize that, no, we're actually not alone. There is millions and millions and billions of planets out there, and most likely very advanced civilizations have developed on them. And I think that we're about to enter a larger community that might be a community that span our galaxy instead of our continents.
Yeah, because sometimes it's like we're in a little over our heads here, you know, and we could use some help. And I mentioned the sun because I don't want everybody, you know, who's listening, if the light goes out for a couple of days, you know, don't panic, don't freak out. If there are visitors that show up, you know, it's just...
Well, instead of shooting, it would be good to extend an invitation. That's really important to understand. You know, it's clear to me from the fundamental logic of the physics I'm writing that a society that's able to go from one solar system to another, which span very enormous distances, is most likely a society that has reached levels of consciousness that dictates benevolence. And, you know, it's remarkable that the Vatican recently released documents almost a year and a half ago, and then again recently, talking about their search for extraterrestrials and their belief that they are benign and that we are on the brinks of discovering new life and new beings out there. And it is not the tendency of the Vatican to be so forward. One example, for instance, is that I think it was 1997 when Galileo was excused or apologized to by the Vatican. And so it's not the tendency for the Vatican to be so forward and so progressive. So it's remarkable that even an institution such as the Vatican is talking this way at this time.
That's pretty exciting in and of itself.
It is. I think it's a good barometer. It's a good gauge on the amazing transformation that's occurring on our planet.
Accelerated evolution. So you've just been in Colorado producing something with Gaiam. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, you know, my DVD set being almost 8 hours of material is a little intimidating for some people. And so we have just finished producing a little movie that is going to be more like an hour and a half to 2 hour long. And this will be a flag DVD that's going to be released hopefully very soon. And it will be easier for people to digest and give a good overview of the concept. And then if people want to dig deeper, they can get the four DVD sets as well.
Fantastic. I can't wait to see it.
It will be fun. I think it's going to be a really interesting piece of information, and many of the things on that DVD updates that were not present on the four DVD set. So I'm excited to release that to the public and have it formally out there.
You know, there's so many great works converging right now, and for me, I believe that the mutation of humanity into a fully realized race will happen through a collective of individual conscious intent affecting the morphogenetic field and transcending the tyranny of consensus reality. Mm-hmm. You know, when we intentionally shift our attention away from the mundane and the status quo, we begin to understand what it takes to be the magician. And through a powerful application of creative intention and knowledge such as you are producing for the world, we can shatter generations of limitations.
You know, very good. I agree with that. Absolutely. And we're in the middle of doing that, so it's a little uncomfortable in between, but just hang in there. It's going to get really wonderful soon.
Buckle your seatbelt and just look forward to grand adventures.
Yes.
So to close today, I just wanted to say that for the past 20 years, you've been directing research teams of physicists and electrical engineers, mathematicians, and other scientists. And you've founded a nonprofit organization, the Resonance Project Foundation, where as the director of research, you continue to explore unification principles and their implications in our world today.
Yes.
And so you can be reached at theresonanceproject.org. Is that correct?
That's correct. At Haramein, my last name, at theresonanceproject.org.
And that's Haramein?
That's correct. And, you know, the foundation has been instrumental in allowing this work to continue and move forward. So anybody that wants to help and contribute is very welcome, and much gratitude for it. Every penny counts, every energy send our way counts, and we're going at it as hard as we can. And it's certainly quite the adventure in this world today.
Yes, and we're so grateful that you are doing that work. It was wonderful having you on the show today, Ms. M. Thank you for being all that you are and giving all that you give. You are certainly making a difference in the world. And as I said, we're grateful, and we are so thrilled to talk to you today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very glad that you're doing this and more people are listening and excited about the transformation. And so I look forward to the next time.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so you've been listening to the No Wonder Show on the World Puja Network. Aloha Nui Loa. Thank you for listening.